Hello and welcome to The Culture Bunker, your pop culture podcast roundup. I'm Sian Pattenden.
And I'm Andrew Harrison. This week we are thrilled to be joined by Claudia Birkin and Suzanne Freitag, aka Ex-Propaganda, purveyors of 80s megapop, now back with an astonishing new album that's every bit as good as their classic A Secret Wish.
And it's an electronic special as we listen to new albums by Soft Cell and Dubstar. Bleep bleep.
Plus, at the movies, it's alternative universes all round in Marvel's Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness, starring Benedict Cumberbatch. And we check out spy spoof The Pentaveret with Mike Austin Powers Myers on Netflix.
All this and more on today's Culture Bunker.
Welcome to The Culture Bunker. We have got fantastic guests today. Let's say hello to the first of them, Claudia Birkin and Suzanne Freitag. We're approximately half of 80s behemoth Propaganda, the European wing of Trevor Horn's ZTT Records. Claudia and Suzanne gave Propaganda an eerie, icy Deutsche drama. And without them, we really have to ask ourselves whether we would ever have had Goldfrapp, Electribe 101, Jenny Beth, Björk, Ladytron, and countless others. Hello, Claudia and Suzanne. It's great to have you in the studio.
Hello.
Wow.
Thank you for introduction.
Amazing.
Well, full disclosure, I am a fan. I'm a huge fan. And I actually got to write the sleeve notes, one of the reissues of Secret Wish years ago.
Right.
It was a proud moment in what I laughingly call a career.
So fantastic. Hello.
Glad to have you here. Your album, as Ex-Propaganda, The Heart is Strange, it's out in a couple of weeks. You did this after a couple of gigs just down the road from our studio here at the Garage in Islington. This is in 2018. And afterwards you decided to start writing new material. What had you missed about working together?
Well, we just always thought that A Secret Wish just stood there on its own as just one record. We just thought that was rather sad. And we always kind of imagined what could a follow-up be. And we also thrived to make it happen. And we came across so many hurdles over the years to make it, to realize it, that Suzanne and I, we were just determined to kind of get it done.
Yeah.
It took us a long time, unfortunately, but it happened.
Well, it's a brief 37 years exactly. Since The Secret Wish and this one. I mean, it is one of those records that kind of, it really stands alone in the 1980s as a kind of, as the exemplar of that kind of stuff, that begins with an Edgar Allan Poe poem, runs through the amazing singles. It's a vast, vast, vast record. And yet you were just telling us that you made it in a studio about the size of this little box that we're in right now.
That's right.
Yes. So we called it the Space Shuttle. Mm-hmm. It was in Studio 2, I think, in Basing Street, in the Psalm Studios, Psalm West. And so it was the smallest studio, and we just did it all there.
Making epic things in tiny, tiny boxes. We're going to hear more about this in a short while. Mm-hmm. We'll touch on our other guests, Sian.
Absolutely. Katie Puckrick is a woman who needs little introduction. Former dancer with the Pet Shop Boys and linchpin of the infamous Word TV show. Katie is also a broadcaster, writer, perfume aficionado, and presents her own podcast, We Didn't Start the Fire. Hello, Katie. Welcome back to Culture Bunker.
Hi. I'm just leaning in to sort of nuzzle your neck because we are sharing a mic, and I love this enforced intimacy. It's the only con I'm allowed.
Yes, it's quite fun in here today, isn't it? We Didn't Start the Fire is a history of 20th century global events seen through the eyes of the Billy Joel song. You invite experts on. So who's been your recent favourite boffin and what did you learn?
Well, we had a fantastic Einstein expert and he was telling us all of the behind-the-scenes tittle-tattle about how Einstein loved the ladies as a big, shameless flirt.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, naughty old Einstein.
Oh, he loved it, but the ladies loved him. And and the way our expert told us about Einstein's, he was so, he kind of bucked up against scientific tradition because you have to break some things to invent a new paradigm. And the way our expert was telling us about him made it sound like a very exciting and sexy children's story because he had this very animated storytelling way about him. And then it turned out that in the 80s, he was the host of a kids program and did some sort of wake up kids club. The Einstein expert's name is David Badanis. He wrote a book about him. And
I know him.
I saw you frantically gesturing to me as soon as I said his name.
Incredible, yeah.
Claudia, how do you know him?
I remember writing him that book because our children went to the same school.
Oh.
As, yeah, so...
His children. His children.
Yeah.
And your his child.
And my daughter, they went to the same school.
So life is indeed
and so cool. we kind of... Yeah.
And so you know what I mean? He's got this very engaging way of, like, you know, big eyes and, you know, telling the story.
Yeah,
and Einstein's
a lovely man.
Yeah, lovely man. Yeah. Einstein's a dirty stop out. Well, not really, but, you know.
Wow. With Einstein had about 5 shirts and they were all the same, weren't they? The ladies just loved his one look. That's quite interesting.
It's like Ron Mayall in Sparks. Wow. You know, you just have to have your one look.
Something.
You know, Andy Warhol, same thing. You just look like an old man even when you're 27, mm-hmm. and then you look like you never age.
Very nice.
You recently wrote a Guardian piece which was recounting times on the word, but it was in context of the idea that Channel 4 may be sold off. What are your views on this? Do you think it's going to happen?
Well, it's hard to fight City Hall when City Hall is a giant bulldozer determined to obliterate culture and all that is good. It's a very spiteful move from the Tory government, isn't it? Mm. It's making me think about the Festival of Britain in the mid-century, which was a Labour government initiative when they were building these pavilions along right across the Thames from the Houses of Parliament and celebrating culture. And it was very popular in that very dour post-war period, and it was so popular with the public, but the Tory government were determined to just raise the whole thing flat. The only thing that's remaining there, I think, is the Royal Festival Hall from that time. Mm-hmm. And this Channel 4 initiative is the same thing. It's actually commercially funded, but they have a remit to supply public-oriented broadcasting, and it's sort of doing the job. It's nurturing new talent. You have Michaela Cole, you have Phoebe Waller-Bridge, you have all of this young talent that wouldn't have been nurtured necessarily on a Netflix, which is what the government is saying. They're trying to turn an apple into an orange, but, you know, it's already a good apple, so let Channel 4 be an apple and let Netflix be the orange.
Before we get going, a reminder, listeners, you can get the Culture Bunker and all of our shows early and without adverts when you support the Bunker on Patreon. No need to privatise, as Nadine Dorries. This means daily episodes on politics, science, pop culture, and much more, plus all manner of exciting merchandising and special shows. Just search Patreon Bunker Podcast to find out more. Now, if it's Saturday, this must be Earth 616. The big movie release of the week is Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness, the latest in Marvel's endless interlocking series, in which Benedict Cumberbatch reprises the role of the Master of the Mystic Arts and does that horns thing with his hands a lot. Following on from the events of WandaVision, where we discover that Wanda Maximoff is actually a complex and terrifying creature called the Scarlet Witch, and Spider-Man No Way Home, where Doctor Strange messes with reality with hilarious consequences. This multiverse movie has a lot to carry. We sent a crack team of nerds to watch it last night. That's me, Alex Andreo, and Ian Dunt. First, though, here's the trailer.
Someone once told me that the reality I thought I knew was just one of many. Careful which path you travel down. Stronger than you have lost their way.
You think there will be no consequences?
We're in the end game now.
I sacrificed everything. And it meant nothing.
Oh, Strange. What have you done? I never meant for this to happen.
Cannot control everything. You brought this on yourself.
You break the rules and become a hero. I do it and I become the enemy. That doesn't seem fair.
Okay, so it's last night and we've just been to the movies. I've just been to see Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness with Ian Dunt.
Hello.
And with Alex Andreo.
Boys' night out!
Lads' night out, lads. So, there's a lot to talk about here. Alex, give us the setup first, exactly what is happening here, and please try not to spoil it.
Oh, good Lord, I didn't know I had to do this. So, what happens is,
the various multiverses begin to touch on each other, fracture a little bit, and our intrepid travelers jump between various ones, trying to correct the thing that's gone wrong.
Did you have to make that sound so sexy?
It's not, I'm going to say, it's not a sexy movie, but it's a very, very, very eventful
movie. Just my way.
Yeah. So, again, this is not much of a spoiler, but our core cast consists of Benedict Cumberbatch as Doctor Strange, Benedict Wong as Wong, Joaquin Gomez as America Chavez, and Elizabeth Olsen as Wanda Maximoff, a.k.a. Scarlet Witch. Ian, what did you think?
I mean, I really enjoyed it. It is exactly what it says on the tin, which is an absolute blather of preposterous nonsense. a relentless blather of nonsense. I mean, it doesn't stop. So it does feel like a cramming together of lots of things, one of which is weaponized nerd delivery. Mm. Just, especially for comics nerds, probably more than most Marvel films. If you know your comics, it is really delivering to you very hard. Then a sort of Sam Raimi horror, which kind of comes out of nowhere, sort of an Evil Dead 2 kind of real tone.
Lots of rotting arms coming out of holes to grab you.
Yeah, and pierced eyeballs and stuff. You sort of think, I wasn't really, didn't really think you were going
to
go that way.
It is Sam Raimi directing, so he's allowed to homage himself.
He is, which he does extensively over and over again.
He might go blind if he homages himself much more.
When you take a step back from it, you sort of think, like, did that all mesh together as a whole? And the answer is probably not. Did I have, a really fucking good time? And I absolutely did.
Yeah. Alex, what did you think?
First of all, I'm still trying to get over the embarrassment of having the two of you actually whooping and applauding next
to me.
You
knew that would happen.
Like, this is fucking 1993 and we're watching a film at the Elephant and Castle Coronet while smoking weed.
Yeah!
I thought that the central narrative, the plot as it were, was enough to fill about an hour, and the other hour was crammed with completely unrelated set pieces. The unrelated set pieces were delicious, by the way. I'm not knocking them, but as a whole, you know, the film could have probably been beefed up by being shorter, but you can see why, and I saw it everywhere in this film. Basically, cinematography and art department, costume department, just went nuts.
Bananas. Absolutely.
Because
bananas.
They could do anything. Well, you know, having them breaking from reality to reality, they could literally do anything.
There is a bit where we sort of see the full implications of traversing multiple realities at the same time. And this part of the film could be subtitled, "Hello, young people. Have you ever tried hallucinogenic drugs? Would you like to take a massive load off them? Because this is what it's like." My issue with this, and again, I hope this is not spoiling it too much, is, you know, I was absolutely buried in fan service here, right? Things happen in this film that make the last Spider-Man movie look blunt and, you know, straightforward. Things happen in this that, at one level, I was utterly delighted about, because characters appear who I thought were last seen drawn on my school exercise book in 1978, and appear in full dimension. Other characters appear who are completely brand new and brand new minted only in animation and comics, suddenly in full flesh, at a massive nerd level, I was very satisfied. At a kind of character story level, I'm not sure I was, because I'm not so sure how Doctor Strange evolves and changes in the course of this movie. Mm-hmm. He just goes through an awful lot of crazy shit. One particular beloved character, I don't think their evolution is going to be very warmly welcomed, shall we say.
I think you're right about this, and there's a danger of something else as well, which is the whole multiverse thing. And to be honest, we have it before. I mean, we had it in WandaVision, and I think we had it a bit in Spider-Man, which is, it's really fun because you get to see all this stuff from other places suddenly being put on screen. But when it ends, you think, okay, but did any of that mean anything, in terms of, do they still exist? Would I still see them going forward? Or have they just gone now?
Is that person who died, are they still dead?
Exactly. I think that's the point. It lessens the peril.
Yeah.
That's my issue with
having
it.
Having a multiverse means you never have to say you're sorry.
If there's all these other ones out there, then, you know, if this one goes to shit, we'll just jump to another universe.
Nerds have a real issue with the kind of Easter egg mentality, which is, you know, what if it was Nazi robots fighting dinosaurs from space, right?
I would watch that.
Yeah. I mean, right, so would I, actually. Now that I've said it, I can't stop thinking about it.
No, but you wouldn't.
But it's not, the thing is, yeah. none of that has any heart to it. What people liked when they watched the last Spider-Man film, really what they liked was the heart, right? Yeah. They've been with these characters for time and there's the heart. There's a danger with the multiverse things, you just keep on giving us what we want as... Here is the one image that you
want. Endlessly renewable. Yes.
Right, but there's no real sort of soul to the thing. I'm not saying that that's what happens here, but watching it today, I got my first flickers of nervousness.
Yeah.
That when we really go into this multiverse thing, that's what we're going to end up. Now that we've done the negatives, we should probably say some of the positives.
Let's get out of the negative zone, Ian.
Right. I really like Sam Raimi, and not just the Spider-Man things, but the Evil Dead. But I even mean like the older Evil Dead, sort of squidgy, cheap... Yeah. Yeah. Raucous horror, and he brings that sensibility here, not just in terms of how things look, but just the joy of it, like the rigorous joy that is like, I'm going to give you, you think you want one cake, I'm going to stuff three cakes down your mouth, and I can't stress how relentless it is. So by the end of it, you're like, thank you Sam Raimi for Sam Raimi-ing the fuck out of this.
There is also one incredibly brilliant Sam Raimi in joke.
There's a brilliant
pizza. It's just awesome.
It's really very, very good indeed. And fans of the Evil Dead 2 will be very, very happy about one cameo and the joke that is delivered on that cameo. You should stay to the end of the credits.
Yes.
I think that's
quite a good summary, actually.
Yeah.
You leave feeling you've had a bit too much cake.
Yeah.
Right, but then again, too much cake is not the worst thing.
And the next morning, you might think, were some of those empty calories? And probably they were, but you were sated at the time.
Well, this is Andrew and Ian and Alex returning you to the Culture Bunker in the Baxter Building. We'll see you soon.
Bye.
Sean, what did you think? You went to see it with your son, didn't you?
I certainly did. I had to book days in advance to get our tickets because it was a sold-out cinema and it was on every half an hour. I really enjoyed it, but I think you need to crib up on what's gone on because I'd forgotten some of the stuff of WandaVision. I'd forgotten some of the Marvel Avengers Assemble and all that stuff. Yeah. And I think there are some threads that you really need to know what the family in the Marvel universe is doing before you get to this. I thought Elizabeth Olsen was absolutely incredible. Mm. As the Scarlet Witch and Wanda. You know, is she, you know, she's one or the other. She's either a housewife or she's, you know, obviously the devil.
Housewife demon, which is your golden life.
Well, it is. I mean, we can all relate, right? I thought she was absolutely fantastic. And also, Benedict Cumberbatch is brilliant. He's always really, really good. Mm. And I've seen him do things live and he is so captivating. He's really good at acting. I also love Benedict Wong. As he is Errol in 13 Stories High as well. He's wonderful. It was a real treat for the eyes, but I think I need to go and see it again to work out some of what's going
on. You need your PhD in Marvel. Luckily, I have one.
You do.
If there is a connoisseur choice for the best record of the 1980s, it could well be Duel by Propaganda, a piece of gleaming megapop that united haughty glamour, towering production values, and ladles of art pop resonances. Memorably described as ABBA in hell, Propaganda were a stern and forbidding two-boy, two-girl outfit from Dusseldorf. They were as inspired as much by Throbbing Gristle as they were by Agnetha, Björn, Benny and Annie Fried. Propaganda's releases on Trevor Horn and Paul Morley's fabulously pretentious ZTT label, including Dr. Mabusa, a nightmare translation of German cinema into a 10-minute pop symphony, and the incredible album The Secret Wish all still sound astonishing today, and now Claudia and Susanna are back as ex-Propaganda. The new album The Heart is Strange is out on the 20th of May. We're going to talk about it after this track. This is Beauty is Truth.
Beauty in your eyes.
Beauty is Truth by Propaganda, full track on the Rolling playlist, of course. Claudia and Suzanne, this is a really great record. I mean, we talked about how you'd always wanted to do the next statement after Secret Wish. Did you ever think you would get to do it, though? Because there's been many little, you know, attempts, and you've come together and fall, you know, got apart at different times. Did you think you would actually get to do it?
Yes, I think we were always imagining and wanting and had ideas to work on it. We didn't realise it would take us such a long time, but it did.
I mean, The Secret Wish is so informed by poetry, as I mentioned, by German cinema, by that whole world of... you know, the independent German art culture that you formed in the early 1980s. We're in a very different world now. What kind of things as you were making this record, did you feel were kind of feeding into it? You know, what are you watching? What are you seeing? Do you feel it is a German record in the way that the other one perhaps is a German record?
Well, I've been here for 40 years now, almost. So I'm like any kind of songwriter. So I just react from what's outside, and it's my reaction to it. So, for example, with Beauty is Truth, it's pretty much about fake news. Yeah. Telling people to be careful and be aware and stand by, dismiss, you know, be cautious. So that was the theme, which was also what we thought was very kind of in line with what we used to write about, like the subject matter, and it with propaganda being the word propaganda. And so it kind of, it just seemed to make sense, you know. So.
Yeah, sometimes it takes a while for things to come back into focus, but they're quite in focus now.
Yeah, you said German record. We never thought about it as a German record. I think the first one or the second one. But of course, you know, because we are in the... We were then in the German system, and we wanted to make it sound also European English, and not, you know, but it's probably for you as English, it's a very German.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I remember the thing, you know, when the shock goes, oh, my God, this sounds incredible. Yeah. It's like a Fritz Lang movie.
Yeah, also it was very German themes, you know. I mean, so I think someone said it was Trevor Horn's darkest moment in production. And yeah, it obviously was based on that kind of German history. And
also, I mean, something that I had only recently realised, that, you know, this is a record made from, you know, before Germany had been reunified, and the idea that there's a, you know, it's a split country and we were in a split world. Mm-hmm. And then we weren't, and now it kind of feels like we are again. It's sort of, you know, that thing is returning. I mean, I loved The Secret Wish because it felt so European. Obviously, we've been through Brexit here, and Britain, and you living here have seen it close up. Britain has lost its mind in its obsession with setting itself apart from Europe. As Germans in the UK, how did you feel about that? Did you find it, you know?
I thought it was devastating. I was like super sad to see this happening, and couldn't believe it. It was tragic. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, really sad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And very, I think, really difficult for England. I mean, and Great Britain. I think I'm really worried, I think.
Yeah.
When I think about the future.
Yeah. As I say, you formed on the Dusseldorf Art Underground in the early 1980s. Susan, it was originally your band, wasn't it? It was you and Ralph Dober and Andreas Thein.
Yeah. I think it was Ralph Dober and Andreas Thein, and then I joined. But yes, yeah. We were the beginning, and then Claudia and Michael joined.
And you went very rapidly from doing sessions with John Peel to suddenly getting signed to the most, you know, certainly the loudest and most conspicuous record label of the day. It was all that all seemed to happen very quickly. What are your standout memories of that sort of early period of working with ZTT?
Yeah, I was just saying about John Peel. I mean, this was also before Propaganda. Claudia and I were in a girls' band, and John Peel played us on a kind of, what was it?
We ended up on the Sampler.
Yeah, Sampler.
It
was all these very serious German Dusseldorf musicians and Cologne musicians, and it were mostly men, young men. And then there was like a slot for two songs still available, and they asked us if we wanted to be on that Sampler, so we recorded that song. And it was hilarious because John Peel just played this song.
And the poor guys were really disappointed.
They were very irritated by that. Remember that.
They'd sort of sweated their inspiration to death. And you were the ones.
What was your band name?
Topolinos. What's that? It's called, I don't know what it is, called the Mickey Mouse.
Yeah, in Italian.
It was a bit like pre-Bengals, or okay. It was also a bit like...
We wrote this song,
like,
I think,
Tom Club. Okay. Bit,
yeah, so, in 2 days or something.
Yeah.
It was,
The new record manages to get that gigantic sound. Those sounds are now on a laptop, aren't they? You can create things on much more affordable, much more available software. And you're back working with Steve Lipson, who was one of the ZTT team and the producer of Secret Wish. Mm-hmm. I've been told not to call him Lippo. We've got to call him Steve Lipson. What does he get out of you? How does he coach you? How does he help you, you know, realise the things that you're thinking about?
He just lets us a lot of freedom, I think. He just says, OK, try it out, I'll do it. And then... when we are, for example, recording or something, and it's quite surprising what he gets out of us.
You know, like for example, one song, Don't You Mess With Me, it's just like one straight vocal performance, you know? It's just like so... It's just that he's so easy to work with, and it's also... It was really easy to work with him at the time, like 40 years ago or 38 years ago. And that seemed to be like... nothing had changed. And it's just very playful and not forced. And we didn't sit down thinking, okay, let's make a follow-up to A Secret Wish. Mm-hmm. That we didn't even think about this. This was a consequence of us having not feeling we had not enough material to play in a live setting. Mm. We kind of drew on playing B-sides, and we just thought we really could do it with some new material. Mm. And so it was just all really, really like easygoing. You know, and that I think is Stephen's great talent. You know, you don't even feel like you're recording.
Yeah.
I love this album. I've been listening to it over and over and over to the extent that I did contact your PR to say, can you send me the download? And she was questioning my motives. What are you going to do with it? Like, listen to it and love it some more? Give me a break, lady. But it wasn't quite out yet, so I have to obey the protocol. Mm. But one of the things I love about it is that it still sounds so modern and futuristic, because sometimes bands who start in a certain era almost sound a little dated when they go back to that sound. So your original sound was so futuristic and modern. And even though this is still unmistakably propaganda, it still sounds so fresh and ahead of the game, especially in this environment where, with, I guess, the popularity of video games, and then consequently there's all these 80s sounding kind of pastiche 80s bands. So whether it's... FM 84 or The Midnight or Gunship, bands like that, they sound like they're kind of just Legoing 80 sounds. But you guys are it sounds authentic.
Wow. Thank you.
And also your voices are so distinctive.
Your voices are fantastic.
So all of it is so pleasing. And
how lovely.
And for me, I'm just throwing it out there, guys, for your like late night Netflix and chill cozy needs. I love the last track on the album. What's that one called?
Oh, Ribbons of Steel.
Ribbons of Steel.
Yeah. Ribbons of Steel, that's about German history, you know. That's about a couple that's being divided by the wall. Just, you know, when the fence comes up. First, there was barbed wire that was coming up before the wall was built. And that's about that moment of two lovers being separated by that. Yeah,
I'm so glad to know about that.
That's the theme.
Because I lived in West Berlin when I was a child. My dad was in the Air Force, so during the in the 60s in the Cold War, so I definitely remember driving through Checkpoint Charlie and going to Potsdam, so between the East and the West.
So
I have a visual for it, so thank you for the sonic element.
Okay,
I really like that track as well, Ribbons of Steel. It has the feel of the Inception soundtrack. Well, that kind of like, is it a dream or is it real? Are we experiencing us
right
or not?
Side or wrong side?
Exactly. And actually, it is kind of, in a weird way, it's sort of like a bookend to Dream Within a Dream. I think it's absolutely fantastic. But one of the tracks that I really like, I'm going to play it in a minute. This really stood out to me, and it's going to be very relevant to our listeners, I think. The Wolves Are Returning is about far-right radicalism, neo-Nazis, alternative for Deutschland, the hard right in the UK. And I actually can't believe that nobody else has written a song about this, because this is one of the dominant themes of now. We always thought that we'd vanquished extremism. It was never coming back, particularly in Germany. Yeah. And now here it is. Tell us about this song. Tell us about where it came from.
Yeah, it was really definitely a reaction to the Trump movement and On the other hand, I was also, it's really, we got the idea for it by seeing those pictures and about Trump and
the rallies,
and the rise of, and it was like, oh, this is sounding familiar, you know, or the kind of, we've been here before. Mm.
I think all over Europe, the riots are rising, and there's so many neo-fascistic groups and neo-Nazis. Yeah. It's really worrying. So I think you came up with the wolves, the title, and this is such a good symbol, I think. There are groups called Grey Wolves or something. Mm. Yeah, because in Turkey or... No, yeah. I think in Greece.
That sort of like wolf motif has always been a big thing with neo-Nazis.
But also it's like such an archetype, like the wolf, like in the Brothers Grimm, the wolves and the, what is it called, the Sieben Geißlein?
Yeah.
The seven
dwarfs.
Mm. And goats, the seven young goats, you know, and the wolves knocking on the door and pretending it's the mom coming home. So that was that, you know, the wolf knocking the door. And also there was also at the time when we came up with that was this program about the animal wolves really returning.
The rewilding.
They're regaining territory.
Yeah.
So it was just like something like regaining, and then it just one.
I mean, obviously,
it all came together.
Yeah, it's obviously massively relevant to Germany because this is something that actually your own music is rooted in. You know, Dr. Mabuse's films of Fritz Lang, the interwar period. Does Germany take this more seriously than Britain does because Germany has got to deal with Germany's history? Do you think?
I think they're very very alert.
Yeah.
And wanting to really make sure this is not happening again, you know, so because of, the legacy that we had to carry, also our generations had to carry. I think it's different now. It's more different now with more generations in the past. But when Suzanne and I started out, it was, you know, our grandparents and our parents, you know, they were...
That personal experience.
Personal experience. Yeah. So
I think, and a lot of people, unfortunately, you know, there are a lot... I think German politicians are in denial. I mean, they're alerted, but also at the same time, they're not quite sure how to deal with it, I think. And it's difficult.
Yeah. I mean, we're of a similar age, and I can remember Bader Meinhof in Germany and that sort of generational break, the generation that wanted to hold their parents, their grandparents to account.
Yeah.
And it was a massive national conversation which ran through. But the refrain in the song, instead of doing something, scared of doing something, instead I did nothing. Because I think we also feel a little bit like that. You see things going on.
And you're ignoring it, or you're putting it away and, you know, turning a blind eye.
Yeah.
And that's really... You know,
history repeats.
When history repeats,
You're playing in London at the Garage, which is about 200 yards from our studio in Islington, North London, and it's on 24th of May. Is that right?
That's right.
Okay, so
we'll be down there.
I'm going to be down there.
We'll be down the front. And that's good because we're not very tall. So if you come, you'll be able to see over.
Yeah, if you look down in the front row and see some very small people,
that's us. Yes. So listeners, do join us. Let's have a listen to The Wolves Are Returning.
The wolves are returning, they're on the rise again. We've opened up the door, and now we let them in. We've lost before we started, hatred on all sides. When history repeats, must we take it in our stride? Nothing is certain. Nothing is clear.
Every week we ask our guests to bring in a current favourite track of theirs as a premium service to you, the listener. Katie Puckrick, what track have you brought in and why have you brought it in?
Well, my ears have been tickled by a new collaboration between five leading musicians from London's jazz and experimental scenes. Mm-hmm. The group is called Flock. And this song, which is Expand, I like it because it's sort of Philip Glassy, but sort of Cosmishy. It's based on improv. So Bex Birch, who's one of the participants, he says that the guidance for the rest of the musicians were texts that he wrote. He says, I wrote texts as scores for the session, and the emphasis was on breathing and listening to each other. And he maintains that improv is just a composition in and of itself. But the thing I love about jazz music is that it's surprising. So I like to be surprised. I mean, I like the comfort of pop music and knowing it's going to be lather, rinse, repeat of the verse and the chorus and the bridge and the chorus. But the thing I love about jazz and especially these kind of hybrids is that you don't know what's going to happen next.
And I love it that it's timeless. Jazz just feels so timeless. So
yes, yes, really exactly.
Cosmischer, Philip Glass, I bet propaganda are going to really hate this. This is Expand by Flock.
Now, new music from old favourites. You'd think there was something in the water. The reformed Soft Cell are onto their fifth studio album. It's called Happiness Not Included, 41 years after their debut. And 90s dream pop band Dubstar are also set to release their fifth, the album simply entitled 2, right now. But what can these established synth duos... Hang on, there is a theme to this show. Do you think? Bring to the sonic landscape of 2022. Let's find out. Here's a taster of Soft Cell with Happiness Not Included, and special bonus, the full track of Dubstar with I Can See You Outside.
So wash your hands and sing happy birthday, and you won't sanitize your sins. So much we enjoy, build on broken backs. We can't turn away and paper over the cracks before you. Get deluded, read the small print of life. Happiness not included. Happiness not included.
Remember the way it made you feel.
Katie,
yes,
are you a soft sell aficionado?
Well, I have to say, when I was starting my career as a new wave obsessed teenager, I did have a 12-inch of Bedsitter by Soft Cell. And I was an American teenager in my Northern Virginia suburban bedroom listening to this, and I had no idea what a bedsit was. It was some, like, exotic English terminology. Mark Allman seemed very anguished about it. So I do like and appreciate Soft Cell. Mm. And what I would say about this album is, much like Propaganda as ex-Propaganda, Soft Cell have stayed really true to themselves and only still sound like themselves, and even more so. So the electronic blips and bleeps are quite fresh and just weird enough, like they're not pandering. And then Mark... He's got his style of lyric writing is so literal. It's so like, I went down to the shop and I saw a man and then he gave me a weird look and then I felt strange and then I thought about Andy Warhol. Like, it's all very kind of stream of consciousness, but somehow it is quite, I don't know, emotional. And is that in a French chanson tradition? Is that kind of like you're just narrating your thoughts and, you know, like it's a bit existential, but also it's just very quotidian. Is that the idea?
Maybe. I mean, you're talking about Polaroid, one of the tracks here, which is about when Mark Allman met Andy Warhol in 1982. And he did say it was an extremely underwhelming meeting. And that's what we're getting from the song is, I saw you, you saw me, you didn't say much, I didn't say much. That's what the song is.
Yeah, that's a really good example. I mean, he kind of continues that in the rest of his whole, you know, the rest of the songs. But yeah, that's a great example of it. He said, I said hi. He said, what did
hi.
He said hi, hi. Yeah. G. He said G. I said hi. And he does say G. So Warhol is very kind of monosyllabic in that way. Mm.
Now, as a friend of the Pet Shop Boys, because obviously you keep in touch regularly, I know that.
Oh, we're on the blower every night.
We have the collaboration Purple Zone, which was released as a single shortly. Does it fit with the rest of the album here?
I feel like it doesn't fit with the rest of the album.
So tell us why.
I feel like it sticks out as a, you know, Neil and Chris of the Pet Shop Boys came over for a cup of tea in the studio. Chris turned on the synthesizer, like just threw in the synth stabs from You Are Always on My Mind. Jing, 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 jing. And so I feel like it's nice. Lovely people are having a chin wag. And then they're going on their way again. I don't think it really amounts to that much, but I'm happy that they're together and alive and creating.
Wonderful. Suzanne and Claudia, are you happy that Soft Cell are alive and creating?
Yes, of course.
What did you make of the album?
I think the lyric writing was very intimate, and that was really drawn me into that. In the beginning, I needed a bit of time to, I'm not sure. And then it really grew on me because it was almost like a audio biography or something, like you said. I said hi, he said hi, Angie. I think, that's interesting. It's just, and I loved the production.
Andrew, I got a bit of Cabaret Voltaire, and there's a Shangri-La's percussion in one of the tunes.
Yes.
What did you make of this? Are they fusing the old sound with new, or is it very much old sound?
The irony is that the synth pop of which they were part of the vanguard is now in itself a kind of a heritage form. It is almost
the
folk music, you know, and you can still make new folk music, obviously, but it has become, I don't think it's ossified, but I do think it is now a thing with a 50-year history.
Right.
So everything you do within it is going to resonate with things that have happened in the previous 50 years. They've always had bits of Martin the Vandellas in, haven't they? The pair of them are Northern Soul freaks. And in fact, I think their comeback was actually called Northern Soul a few years ago. Yeah. What I found, I mean, I like this record. It's quite a melancholy record. It's an older Mark Allman looking back on all the things that he used to do when he was a wild enfant terrible. And now finding that the world has strangely become a lot more conservative than it was when he was doing his thing and rolling around on the stage in PVC underpants. I mean, there's one line, they're undoing the 80s one of the tracks. It is, music-wise, it's the cleaner, sharper, non-stop erotic cabaret end of soft sell. It's not The Last Night in Sodom, you know, Jimi Hendrix covers Horror and Abrasion and Einstein's and the Lloyd Barton thing that they threw themselves into in the end and will happily admit now immolated their career at the time. Yeah. So they've got back to that. You know, Dave Ball is an extremely meticulous creator.
Friend of the show, Dave Ball.
Friend of the show, Dave Ball. Yeah. Extremely meticulous producer. And it just it has a lovely tactile quality. But a great melancholy over the top. It's like we've not really encountered the mature electronic Enfant Terrible before, have we? And now we're encountering him.
No, because, I mean, the parallel is Neil Tennant, but he was not an Enfant Terrible. No, he was more the detached observer. Yeah. He's the P.G. Woodhouse of electronic.
Well, I mean, Mark and Dave obviously adored Suicide.
Yes.
And, you know, would follow that route a bit more.
Yeah, a vaguer route.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I just really like the fact that they keep going, you see, and... Yeah, and you know, I think you need to do that as a musician. You just need to, you know, although you have been so much in over time, that you still have things to say and that you react to what's going on. Like we reacted with Wolves, for example, to what's going on. He does the same, you know, so I think it's really important. And it's great to see that people from the era doing it.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And obviously they have had their other projects similarly to you between the albums, but five albums I quite like in 41 years. Mm. James Joyce, if you do an approximation of his writing, 90 words a day.
Lazy sod.
But I think there's something to it. That always makes me feel better when I haven't had a very productive day. I see these, it's similar as, you know, we'll make an album every 10 years. Almost.
You know what I loved about the Soft Cell album? Mm. I was just thinking about it, playing it back in my head quietly as we chatted amongst ourselves. The soul singers, you start kind of warming it up towards the end. So it starts quite angular and, you know, confessional and emotional, but also kind of detached with the, you know, the electronica. And then gradually you get the heat and the warmth and the comfort of these soul voices sort of crooning in. And I like that dissonance between those two styles.
Should we move on to Dubstar, who also made their fifth album in a few years? Who should we start with? Andrew, because I think this has got you written all over it. We played Token, one of the singles, a few weeks ago. They are now a duo. They released album one 4 years ago. What did you think of this one?
Well, this is kind of record that's almost designed for my approval because it is, again, grand megapop. It's a Stephen Haig production, True Faith, Stephen Pet Shop Boys, Haig. Beautiful couture electronic pop with a lot of scale to it. Again, a theme is emerging this week, isn't it? But also, I find it extremely relatable because it's midlife megapop, actually. It's breakdown of relationships. It's realizing that certain things are not going to happen in your life and maybe you should treasure the things that are. And maybe that you missed out on certain things that you should have been paying a little bit more attention to. I mean, they were always half Smiths, half Pet Shop Boys and a large chunk of St. Etienne, weren't they? Very much part of the world of Britpop. They were on Food Records. Home of Blur and Jesus Jones. So they were kind of connected to all of that. I love Sarah's voice. I think it is so clean and so English. And also I like the fact that for once we're getting a proper Northern accent in pop. Here is a woman who will sing Glass. That I find great. I mean, full disclosure, I'm doing a Q&A with them tonight at Rough Trade East. So ha-ha, yes. But this is kind of, to make a record of such scale... They're on their own independent label. They're going to finance this all themselves. Yeah. There is no...
Which I think makes a difference to you.
Polymer Records are not behind this. Yeah. So they've been able to do it on their own terms. Yeah. And yet it hits all the points that you would have expected something with major level finance behind it. I think it's really good.
I agree. Totally I think it's agreed. Really... It's very crisp and bell-like almost. I mean, the production is very light and it's lovely. And somehow I think her vulnerability in the voice and in the lyrics is great.
Did you like it, Sean?
Yeah. I really enjoyed it because, you know, when you think a band might just be a facsimile of themselves, that something may get lost in the translation, and especially if it's been so long, you're kind of worried. And I had a feeling that they always didn't get their due anyway in the 90s. Yes, they had hits, but because they had a female singer, I don't think that they were given the cred and that they were given the props that they should have been. Because some of their songs are just exceptional. And the way, as we're saying, that Sarah sings in her own accent, she has this Rita Tushingham, very I say what I feel, and the spade is a spade, and yet there's all this melancholy that goes through it. There is such a strength within her, but without kind of over-singing or over-performing in that.
Yeah.
That when I heard this, I just thought, this is it. I mean, probably the best album that they've made.
Yeah,
Stephen Haigh production is absolutely perfect, and it seems seamless, and that's the trick, isn't it? Because songs aren't always easy to construct.
Yeah.
They don't always work out first time. Katie, what did you think?
One of my favorite songs of the entire 90s was Stars by Dub Star. And I would listen to it over and over again when I was questioning a relationship I was in. Is it enough? And I don't even know, I couldn't even tell you what the lyrics are about, but there was just a feeling of the sadness, the poignancy of, you know, the combination of the purity of her voice with the sorrowful feel of the music. And I felt like, listening to this album, I know you're talking lyrically that it has a depth to it and a darkness or maybe just a truthful acknowledgement of things going to hell in a handbasket when you reach a certain age or that past the halfway point in your life. But I felt like I missed that oomph that I got out of them in the 90s. And it might just be because I'm older as well. And also I know what to expect from them. It didn't quite nourish me in the way the Ex-Propaganda album did. Like that was a real
surprise.
It's
not a competition, you know, Katie. It's not a competition.
No, I'm just lining up. I'm just lining up my favorite pop stars, and it's not because you guys are sitting opposite me, but there's just something so exhilarating about your work. But what is great about Dubstar's work is very comforting, and my favorite thing about that album and about the band is I think of them as almost a British folk band. It sounds like contemporary folk because of her voice. Her voice is very plain song folky to me.
Like Pentangle Go Rave.
Maybe. Now, I don't think we've ever had four women in the studio before for Culture Bunker and one man. But can I say, ladies, there's a song called Hygiene Strip. I mean, that was enough for me as well. What a great title.
What a great title. I love it. I have to hand it to them. And they aren't mentioning Gusset, though, in that song. It's a metaphor. Is that right?
The hygiene? I think it's a metaphor, but I would rather it was, you know, not. It was actually about buying a swimsuit in Marks, not being able to
do that. So do you know, Andy?
I have no idea. Having a clue. I thought
you feel excluded, yeah.
Yeah, I do. I feel not seen. I thought it was about, you know, the thing that you put across your nose to stop yourself snoring that Robbie Fowler used to wear.
That's nothing to do with hygiene. It's when you are going to try on underwear or a swimsuit and there's a plastic sticky back strip on the gusset.
This.
Just in case
next time I do it,
just imagine the glistening leftover.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So it's
yeah,
not anyway. About COVID, it's about actually buying underwear.
I don't know. It's a metaphor for life.
Well, yes.
You can recreate all of humanity just by scraping off the residue on the hygiene strip.
Yeah. Well, I feel we've
if
really
you get into a lab.
Yeah, yeah. I feel we've really entered a whole new realm for the podcast show.
A scientific one.
You had to geek out with Dr. Strange.
I did,
we talk about hygiene strips. Anyway, what would we recommend? I mean, obviously, Katie's just completely in love with Ex-Propaganda.
Yes.
You can't get them out of your
head. I can't, no.
But it's a great album. I really enjoy it.
I really recommend it.
Same here.
I love the album.
Now it's Suzanne and Claudia's turn to bring in a current favourite tune, their editor's recommendation, as it were. So what track did you guys choose, your current favourite one?
It's Impossible by Röyksopp and Alison Goldfrapp.
And why did you choose this? What's speaking to you?
It just seemed so, the electroness of it. And just a really good attitude and synth pop, you know.
Yeah.
So it was very relatable.
Yes. yes. So, Alison Goldfrapp, stern woman with electronic beats.
Really liked us. It just was a cool tune. We just thought.
I think there's definitely a bit of a lineage from Propaganda to the world of Goldfrapp.
But also the dance music angle, because Propaganda at the time we there was that element as well, and there seemed to be just a connection, and so we chose that one.
We reviewed this album last week. It is a cracking album.
Yeah.
Let's have a listen.
Great
this
tune.
Is breaks up with Impossible with the guest vocals of Alison Goldfrapp.
You may not have been aware that the Pentaveret is a secret society operating from a very secret locale, comprising of five of the richest people in the world. They may run the world, but they are a benign force, if not intensely private. But before you reach for your tinfoil hat, this truth is only reality if you're watching Mike Myers' Netflix series, The Pentaveret, hence the name. With Myers playing all but one of the secret society, plus many more roles besides, is this the conspiracy comedy, the con-com, we need right now? P.S. Andrew's happy because show favourites, Orbital, are in charge of the score, so let's try and not ask him too much about that, because I know that will have made your day, Andrew.
Yes.
Let's listen to the trailer.
In 1347, five learned men realized that the Black Plague was caused by fleas on rats. However, the church believed the plague to be God's punishment, labeling these five men heretics. So they formed a benevolent secret society to influence world events, known as the Pentaveret.
The Penta what the fuck?
What is this?
You gotta do an exposé on
it. You break a story like the Pentaveret. You can do something good for this world.
I haven't had this much fun since I was at a nudist colony and accidentally backed into a meat thermometer.
Katie Pockrick, I am going to start with you. Mike Myers was at the top of his game about 20 years ago. He's been relatively quiet for the last decade or so. Is the Pentaveret the right comeback? Does it hit the right targets?
I found it gentle, sometimes a bit flaccid and tepid, and sometimes bursting out with a bit of tumescent delight. It wasn't like a laugh riot. I didn't need to unzip my sides, but I appreciated the intelligence behind it. The targets were really good. The whole idea of conspiracy theories, empowering even more ridiculous conspiracy theories. Some of the characterizations of goofy local television, regional television anchormen, or, I don't know, stoner dudes seemed a little broad. But because it's Mike Myers, you just love him. You know, he's just kind of lovable. So I only watched one episode. I am going to watch more.
Okay.
It's sort of old-fashioned, but not bad because of that.
So the plot is based on the newcomer, Hobart Clark, who is joining the Pentaveret. It's contrasted, as you say, with this old-school Canadian news reporter called Ken Scarborough, who is played, obviously, by Mike Myers, because he plays most of the things. He needs a big scoop, so he needs to find the secret society. Did this push the right buttons for you, Claudia and Suzanne? Obviously, you're one person.
We merged into one anyway. And we watched it yesterday. We watched it together.
Oh, okay.
And it was difficult to get used to, but they are really funny. I mean, you know, I like the Con, for example, and the you know, the 2001 references and the fake news and other. So that was really good, but we had some problems with, I don't know, how do you, with the humour?
Toilet humour?
It's a lot of toilet
humour.
It's quite scatological, yes.
Yeah.
I think I will watch another episode.
But that's what we said. We saw one episode. And we said, at least we should watch another one. So where is this going?
Who's the audience? Because it is like potty humor, but then there's sort of incisive social commentary on what's happening in politics. And
yes,
there's
the S word satire as much as scatological. This is something about conspiracy theories, fake news.
It's scatire.
You've done it. Yes. What did you think,
Andrew?
Is it your kind of thing?
Well, I actually like both kinds.
Your face is lighting up.
I actually really enjoyed it, not just because the soundtrack by Orbit, Lizard, Marvelous soundtrack. I liked it a lot. It's good and stupid in the best possible way.
It's silly. Silliness is really
good and stupid.
What it really is, do you remember the scene in Austin Powers where we're in Dr. Evil's headquarters with his hench persons around the table? And, you know, Dr. Evil is stopping and threatening them and killing them with gas, the supply. It's basically a gigantic extended riff on that. The idea that the secret rulers of the world, who are pulling all the strings, the Illuminati, are actually A, ridiculous, B, vaguely benign. And these guys are kind of, you know, Lord Lordington is clearly Stanley Johnson. There's a disgusting Australian newspaper magnate. Who can that possibly be? So they're very, very broad satires on existing things. But what I liked about it was, this is a satire on all the terrible modern concerns that we've got of fake news and climate change and conspiracy thought and radicalization and extremism. And it's handled very, very lightly and in a very silly way, which is both refreshing and also gives you the sense that maybe these things can be handled. You know, I loved Don't Look Up. I thought it was great.
Yes, I do agree.
But God, was it depressing. It was like, there is no hope.
We
are going to die. Nothing can be done about this. And what Mike Myers does here is he points out, we've all heard of the banality of evil. He points out the stupidity of evil and the silliness of evil. So I actually found it really enjoyable. I am going to talk about the soundtrack for a minute because Orbital soundtrack is great.
Go on then.
Lalo Schifrin is here.
Yeah.
But it's basically, the whole thing is based on The Box. Remember The Box? The hit.
Yeah,
the theme tune. But it is meticulous down to the level. The motif from The Box, that kind of, I think it's a dulcimer, isn't it? Do-do-do-do-ding. When you press the door button to open a door at the Pentaver, that's the little noise you get. And I love that.
Which is in itself a reference to the saint, isn't it?
Yes, it's a reference to the saint and it's a reference to the prisoner. The typeface is the prisoner typeface. So remember the prisoner? I don't remember. All that kind of thing.
The prisoners.
It's great. It was fantastic. Patrick McGoohan. And so it's actually, there's a lot of depth to it. It is a, I hate to say love letter, but I'm going to say it. It's a love letter to that school of television. You know, the Champions, the Persuaders.
But also Peter Sellers, obviously, who was someone who played multiple roles in films, but also satires, on global politics and history. And, you know, I mean, this is the same ground, but Myers' treatment. Can we mention Lydia West?
We can. She's great.
It's a Sin's Lydia West. It plays the assistant of this old news hound, Ken Scarborough. And she doesn't have a massive part, but she's brilliant, isn't it? Well, I just really loved her. She's just got absolute dry humour.
There is a strain to this show, which is, a lot of the comedy comes from Canadian... it's Mike Myers, Canadian, making mock of Canada. They're trying to throw me out of my job. And you went to say, we've got to get out there and just go and find the story. And it's really gentle and it's affectionate and it's silly, but also it's new. You don't see that a lot. He's allowed to do it because he's Canadian.
Yeah. There's a wonderful thing where they go to that conspiracy convention, and obviously it's filled with tinfoil hatters. They're almost getting swept up in it. Well, you don't see baby pigeons, do you? And there's a kindness, I think, to his comedy. You don't always get with Sacha Baron Cohen, who could be
sweet. He's very sweet.
There's something about it where you just go, Friday night, have a lager and watch this. It's exactly what I thought.
I watched two, and there's a bit in the second episode where they start to play around with the form of the show. So this is a spoiler, but suddenly the screen changes, there's a Netflix executive who says, "Hello, I'm Ken from Netflix. You might not be expecting this kind of show. Maybe it was a little bit more like this. You might enjoy it more." And the same scene reruns.
They take out the same scene, and it's worse.
And it makes it even immeasurably worse. So it's very clever and very inventive and silly at the same time. So I loved it.
I think this is getting a Friday night thumbs up, isn't it?
I have to say it was a little more gentle. Maybe I just am
expecting Pinchot by it.
I eased into it like you ladies did as well. I came in with a certain level of expectation, and then I thought, okay, it's this other thing, and I am going to go in for episode two. Okay. Take it from there.
I must admit, when I was watching it, I was thinking, oh my God, ex-propaganda are going to hate this because they're kind of sophisticated European old ladies with so high, high-minded, serious. Well, I'm glad everybody liked it.
We did.
Bye. finally, regular listeners know, we also ask our guests to suggest their favourite songs of all time to add to our rolling playlist. The link is in the show notes, of course. Claudia and Suzanne, you've got two songs that you're going to add to the greatest music of all time. What are they?
Night Porter by Japan.
Why is this the greatest song ever made? Why do you love it so much?
I just like the length of it, also the way it builds.
Yeah.
And it's just an elegant piece.
It is possibly the most atmospheric thing so to elegant. Make the top 20, isn't it? It's so much not a pop song, and yet was vastly, vastly popular.
Yeah, and I just liked it because it just like, it has like, it just builds so slowly.
Mm-hmm.
And I like that, you know, when it just kind of ignores the rules a bit, you know. Yeah.
Mine is Lou Reed, Perfect Day, because that is a song which sticks out over the years again and again and again. I love it.
Fantastic. Well, we'll stick those straight onto the playlist. And Katie Puckerick, you get your choice. The greatest record ever made. What is it?
Joni Mitchell's The Hissing of Summer Lawns, which is the title track from The Hissing of Summer Lawns. I listened to it first when it came out, and I was too young to fully appreciate the ennui deluxe that she was describing, the flattened spirit of the caged bird of the suburban housewife, the bougie housewife who is just ensnared in her husband's wealth and her soundtrack in her Beverly Hills life are the sprinklers that are just watering the lawn. That's the hissing of the summer lawns. And it's so moody and blue and chilly and jazzy. And I thought, I can't wait to be an adult and be sad.
Great album.
I also thought there should be a kind of a hip hop exploration of those same themes for the modern day called The Dissing of Summer Lawns. People would buy it.
I'd love that.
And with that, we're at the end of the podcast. And it's closing time chatter. What will we be discussing as we stare icily at the camera, turn on our heel and walk down a ghoulish alleyway? Was that propaganda? Human League? Who was it? Anyway, I think we're all looking very icy and very cool today. Andrew, what is your closing time chatter?
Well, I just want to make the point that everybody needs to realise that Liverpool's journey to the Champions League final grand procession began with our goalkeeper heading one in against West Brom 12 months ago. This is pure kind of butterfly wings chain, creates a hurricane thing.
Yeah.
If Alisson hadn't managed to get a header in, and goalies never score, we know
this.
If he hadn't managed to head one in against West Brom, we've never got that extra little point that qualified us. And now, possibly the greatest achievement in football is about to happen, all because the goalie managed to score a header. And if I could capture the blank looks in this room right now and put on Instagram.
I see your mouth opening and closing and I hear blah, 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 blah.
Yeah. Katie, what is your closing time chatter?
I'm thinking about letting the wind ruffle my hair as the summer sneaks up on us. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking about doing this via investing in a pair of rollerblades. And rollerblading up and down the South Bank.
Ooh,
because I've noticed that in this day and age, young people are certainly taking to the streets with all manner of wheeled vehicles, like weird unicycles from the future and skateboards with too many wheels on them. And I'm thinking, you know what? I want to get back out there in the mean streets of the kids wheeling and rolling and flying along. So I want to rediscover my youth. That's my top tip.
That's a good idea. I think we really got into female skateboarders recently, walking the street, Claudia and I, and there's some such good-looking young women who are fantastic on skateboards.
Yeah.
And I think it's just a new thing because they're now in their 20s and their parents obviously took them out and taught them how to skateboard. And that's why, you know, I thought, yeah, you're right.
They seem like so free and powerful.
Fast and and great, yes.
Maybe we'll all be doing it.
Closing down chapter, we were thinking about, Elon Musk buying Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an interesting concept, I think. You know, people buying something big and for the sake of free speech. But is it really... Or what's behind it? You know, is this to suppress certain other news?
It's weird because he seems to be taking a free speech fundamentalist position that everything will be allowed.
Mm.
Because when you allow everything, you actually enable the suppression of speech because people get shouted down because, verbal attacks and pylons and fake news and misinformation.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
These are actually forms of suppressing free speech. The idea of just let everybody say everything is going to solve it. I think there's a huge debate coming down the line on this, particularly because he's winning the argument with money.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. You know? Yeah. Yes, yeah. He has an agenda. Right. The agenda is money. And the agenda
I would like to see Twitter nationalised and run by the Pentagon. Those guys would know what they were doing.
Essentially, would mean Mike Myers
and Lord Waldenson.
Scatological tweets everywhere.
Sean, how about you?
Eurovision is next week, and I did have a look at the Sam Ryder video, which is the UK entry, and I did feel immediately sorry for him because last year, as you know, the UK got 0 points.
This is even worse, this one. Are we going to get minus points?
I mean, bless him, it's a nice song, but it really is. It's not a point winner, and there's going to be so much going on next week
on. Well, Ukraine's going to walk it, obviously. Yeah,
absolutely. And why not? I mean, I think that's rather wonderful.
I saw your notes out the corner of my eye, and I thought, why are we sending Sean Ryder to Eurovision? That would be great, wouldn't it?
Do it. Now, that would be it. Yeah. Sean.
Eurovision!
Yeah, come at you. Be on one.
Is Russia in the Eurovision Song Contest?
No, I think they've been binned. They've been kicked out of everything else. They're not allowed in the football. They're not allowed in the Eurovision.
Absolutely. But poor guy. Good luck to you, Sam.
And you're doing your art.
I certainly am. So I'm going to do my fundraiser. Usually goes to Great Ormond Street, but this year it is going to go to the Red Cross Ukraine Appeal. Every year, and it's going to be the 10th year running, is I do art on the side. It's my side hustle, but I live draw all the Eurovision acts in real time, which is less than 3 minutes thing, in watercolour. And watercolour paper, beautiful little postcard size things. Wow. If you bid some money via my Just Giving page, which will be on Twitter at the weekend, then you may actually receive an artwork. And I send them out. My donation is I pay for the postage and packaging and the materials, but you actually get an artwork.
Yeah, and you pay with the sweat of your brow.
It's really hard. And I'm doing it live, so amazing. It's absolutely terrifying. And I do it on Twitter, so I've done it now for 10 years, so I can't actually stop.
Great
do
idea.
Do you prefer solo artists rather than 8-piece bands because it's quicker and easier to do?
God, it's when there's fire. It's when there's fire. And it's really difficult. And then the fire's in somewhere else. It's hard because you really have to gauge what's going to happen in 3 minutes in the first 10 seconds. You do miss stuff. But it's actually quite exciting. And people really cheer it on. So it's quite
I
nice
think what should
do.
Happen
oh,
is
nice. That's brilliant.
Next Propaganda's show on the 24th at the garage. I think you should be set up with a little easel at the back and you've got to paint all the songs as they happen.
I have live painted on stage before with musicians.
Brilliant.
Yeah,
really?
I've painted
have
a big
you?
Acrylic. Yeah.
How brilliant.
Yeah. That was terrifying. Oh, wow. I can't mention it.
Sean, it's like you're like a courtroom sketch artist.
Yeah, like that.
Fantastic. For crimes against music.
Exactly.
Well, on that art bombshell, that is the end of the podcast. Thank you so much to Claudia Brücken and Suzanne Freitag of Ex Propaganda for joining us.
Well, thank you. Thanks
it's
for
really
having us.
Yeah. Thank you.
It's been great fun. And thank you so much to Katie Puckrick for being regular on the Culture Bunker.
Happy to be here.
Happy to have
brilliant.
You.
Yeah. Thank you.
Listeners, remember, you can get all the tunes on our rolling playlist. The link is at the top of the show notes. Also, we'll add some of those Ex Propaganda ones when they're actually out, because some of them aren't out yet. From me, I'm from Sean, from producers Alex Rees, Yelena Sofronevich, and Elena Gamatra. Thank you for listening. We'll see you next week.
Bye.
The Culture Bunker was produced and presented by Andrew Harrison and Sean Pattenden. The producers were Yelena Sofronevich and me, Alison Becker. Alison Goldfrapp. Alex Rees. With assistant production from Elena Ganatra. Music by Kenny Dickinson. The Culture Bunker is a Podmasters production.